Hey y'all, Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Welcome to another BritFlix.com podcast. My name's Stuart Wright, and today's guest is screenwriter Matthew Darby. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. It's great to be here.
Good man, good man. We're going to talk a bit about your film, Gone in the Night, directed by Eli Horovitz. We'll talk a little bit about how that collaboration worked. We're also going to delve into three films that have impacted everything in your adult life after we've done that, which I'm excited to do, given the choices. And we'll get to that when we do. But first off, do you want to give people a brief synopsis to what Gone in the Night is all about?
Yeah, sure. So it starts with a couple, and they are on a weekend getaway. Their relationship is on the rocks, and they're trying to kind of salvage things. They get an Airbnb, they pull up to the Airbnb, and there's another couple already there. And so the story sort of unfolds from there, and it is a bit of a sort of puzzle box mystery. It twists and turns from there. I don't want to spoil too much of what happens after that.
No, that's cool. That's a hell of a sell. So in writing that and working with Eli on it, what was the kernel of the idea that sort of led to the film that people can see today? Where does it start for you?
Yeah. So Eli and I have collaborated on a bunch of different projects over the years. And one project that he collaborated with another writer on was the podcast Homecoming, which came out in, I think, 2016. It was a really, it kind of reinvigorated that the scripted audio format and got a lot of attention. Eventually, he became the showrunner for a TV version.
Amazing TV show. Amazing TV show.
Oh, yeah. I think it's fantastic. And so, so this production company, Boulder Light Pictures, approached Eli somewhere, 2018, and they were like, "We love your stuff. We'd like to give you, this budget to make whatever you want."
Oh, wow.
And Boulder Light, so Eli was like, "Oh, that's a great offer." and so Boulder Light had historically, they're a horror production company. And so that sort of got Eli's mind into the space of like, well, what could we do in the horror space? Like, how could we make an interesting take on a horror theme? And so he hit me up because I'm the person he goes to whenever he's got like just a, he wants to just blue sky something, because I'm always ready to dive in. And so he had, there are these two concepts that he had. One was this idea of a double booking. He was renting an Airbnb at the time and had some strange experiences. And so that was sort of the initial kernel. And then we had also been talking about Peter Thiel, that sort of eccentric tech billionaire who was using, like paying 20-year-old men to give their blood to him so he could have these transfusions because he thought it was a sort of fountain of youth. And so so the movie was just like, we had these two poles, like these two ideas, and we're like, how do we fit these together? So the process of writing was like starting with this idea of this couple pulling up to this Airbnb and then ending with this kind of like vampire narrative, or like a, you know, what is a 21st century vampire? Probably like a tech billionaire who, you know, is like sucking the blood out of Generation Z. So and so in, you know, as we were sort of like trying to make to like write toward the middle of these two poles, we sort of set, you know, it became this story about aging and the fear of aging. And so we had we have these characters that represent like the four generations of like Gen Z, Millennial, Gen X, and Boomers, and like how do they, how do their desires interact and create the forward motion of the story? So, you know, it became sort of that's where we found the kind of like personal stakes in it as you know, as two creative people in our 40s trying to deal with these questions of aging and permanence and mortality. And that's the kernel.
So once that begins to unfold in front of you, what then became the sort of main storytelling challenges in terms of executing that?
Well, it was really the timeline. Because it's a mystery that unfolds through the perspectives of those characters. And so we were moving forward in time and then stopping and going back and looking at the events through another character's perspective. And, you know, I think we sort of entered into it thinking that this was going to be, this was going to give us all kinds of freedom to, like breaking the linear timeline, but it actually became, quite tricky, because, you have to deal with, not only like making sure that the story is linked together and that the tension is, building, throughout the story, but you have to, there's this sort of audience attention that we were recognizing as we were writing the drafts that like, you had to keep, like the audience can only hold so much memory in its sort of RAM, right? So we had to, if we were breaking the timeline and going back, we had to, develop these clear cues and markers in the storyline so that, so that an audience could understand that like, oh, now it's 3 weeks earlier and we are looking at it from the perspective of the, the partner, the person who disappears. It was very tricky and required a lot of like drafting scenes and rearranging them on the proverbial corkboard. I should also say that we live on opposite coasts of the state, so I'm on the East Coast and Eli's on the West Coast. And so we actually never met in person writing this, the whole story. But one advantage of this time lapse is that, I get up at 4:30 in the morning. That's when I do my writing. And so So I would get up, draft a scene, send it to Eli. He would wake up, you know, 3 hours later, read it. We'd, you know, like we'd get on the phone at noon my time, which is like right after he's woken up and given notes and feedback. And then I'd have the rest of the day to sort of iterate on that. So, so that we sort of like made the time zones work in our favor, which was, you know,
it's interesting.
Turned out
yeah,
to be a really efficient way to work.
Yeah. Cause I interviewed, Lucas Daunt, who's the Oscar nomination for the Belgian film Close this year. And he collaborates with a screenwriter, and what they do is they write the same scene each and then compare. So they discuss going to be, and then they go off and write it themselves. And he said he would write something with no, more or less the pattern was his would have no dialogue and his screenwriters would be full of dialogue. And it was kind of like they'd marry the two.
That's
kind of
incredible. Oh, that's such a, that's that sounds so fun.
Hmm.
Too, to like as a creative exercise.
Absolutely.
Right, to like write the same scene, and then how do you there must be like all these interesting ways you can interleave them.
Yeah, because it's that really thing cool. Of like, because we know that ideas are 10 a penny, and if you know the story of two people picking up finding a double book Airbnb can go infinite amount of ways, can't it?
Totally.
It's a great idea, but it can go infinite amount of ways. Right. So therefore the idea of splitting the infinity on a scene, like what would you do knowing full well what the execution's meant to be or the purpose of the scene.
Yeah.
Well, look,
that's very cool. I'm going to use that.
You got to find someone to do the exercise with.
Yes. Exactly.
Well, look, thank you for sharing that. It's always good to sort of get our heads around about how people's process works, because I think one of the things that I definitely think I've learned through trying to find my own process is that it is your own process that works. There isn't you can try obviously what you've seen other people do, but ultimately the only one that's any good to you is the one you find that works. And that, and the more people enter me, the more like literally that was a new one to me as well, you know? Well, look, let us jump into three films that impacted everything in your adult life. Now, before we do, I'm just going to speak to the listener who might have joined this podcast for the first time and isn't aware of the format. So you've given me three film titles that are part of the formative years of your life, part of like what made you maybe pay attention to the form, where you might have just been this thing that would entertain you. Then suddenly you're like, hold on a minute, what's this? This thing that people keep putting in front of me. Or even like the memories of who you watched it with, where you watched it, how you got to watch it, those kind of things. And what we'll do is, to make it fun, we're going to do it against the clock. So we'll have 5 minutes on each film. And then every 5 minutes, when we hear this sound, you hear that okay at your end, Matt?
Yep.
Good, man. So when it's DEFCON 1, that's when we move on to the next film.
Fantastic.
So, without further ado, I will prompt you with the title, and then the clock will start, and then we'll talk about. I'll listen to what it is for you, and we'll have a chat about it. Is that okay?
Perfect.
Okay. Starting the clock on 1980s, The Elephant Man.
Yes. Okay. So, growing up, I was sort of on the cusp of the era where VCRs were affordable for families. So this dates me. But before that, there was an appliance store in our town on our main street that rented this thing called a video disc player. And video disc was this dead media format that was actually a phonograph record. It predates Laserdisc. It was a phonograph record that had like super, insanely sensitive stylus that could read these. And they had like a cache of maybe like 50 films. And so it was a big deal. Like on my birthday, I got to rent this video disc player. And so for my sixth grade birthday, I selected the double feature of The Elephant Man in 2001, which is a real party, you know, like a real party. But these two films like completely, you know, blew open my
can I just take you
like,
back to
creative
the,
consciousness.
Can I take you back to the 12-year-old picking those two films? Like, had you gone for them, or was the allure of the covers what got you in the when you were there?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I think I had heard about 2001, and I definitely, you know, I was into science fiction. We'll get into that a little bit more later. So I think there was an allure to that film. And then The Elephant Man, I think it was a bit of an odd choice, but I had seen, I'd seen this clip from on television of, John Merrick, The Elephant Man, like running through the sort of like, London Underground being chased by this mob. And he, you know, it's when he shouts, "I'm not an animal, I'm a human being." And that it sort of terrified me, both because it was black and white, and it was this like disfigured human trying to like declare, his humanity over this crowd. There's just something really disturbing about it. And so and the fact that it was a black and white film that came out in 1980, all of those, it just had this weird allure. And so, so I watched it with my friends and, so I think what struck me, you know, like I could talk about, you know, I think it is such a tightly structured film. A classic, it's a classic three-act structure. Mm. It's beautifully scripted, and you could set a clock to the sort of like moments of transformation in the script. And recently I did that. I like looked at looked at the timeline of the film and like, you know, David Lynch is known for these like very bizarre.
Yeah, it's the least Lynchian, isn't it?
Films that, yeah, exactly. And so, but the, you know, it's, that film is evidence that he...
It's time for another season of The Palmetto Porch, an original podcast from Discover South Carolina. I'm Devin Whitmire. Join me as I get to the heart of what makes South Carolina such a great place to visit by speaking to the locals who make it so special. Premiering December 5th, find The Palmetto Porch wherever you get your podcasts. And for more information about our show, visit scpalmettoporch.com.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Knew the language of film inherently, which enabled him to, you know, mess with it in later films. And so, so I think, you know, formally I was like, I was aware that I was in the presence of this like artistic creation, you know, and that was that sort of like, got my, you know, like caught my creative attention. But then it's also, you know, it's like a deeply empathetic film. And I think it is about, at its core, you know, it's about what it means to be human. And I think so as a sort of like growing, you know, sort of like trying to understand like where I fit in the world, you know, it really impacted me, you know, as a human, as a, like a moral being, and like, understanding this, this man who is like, disfigured beyond recognition, but who had this, you know, human soul that was trying to get out. And, and it's also, this, you know, there's the narrative of John Merrick, the Elephant Man. And then there's the narrative of, Treves, the doctor who, you know, at first tries to like save him and, you know, ends up recognizing that he's participating in the freak show. All right. Wow.
That was 5 minutes, sir.
Wow. That is fast. That was faster than I thought. I didn't even get to cover what I needed to. I'm going to have to be sharper for the next one.
Well, do you want, is there anything?
I want to win this. I want to win this, Stuart.
Is there anything you want? Is there anything obvious you want to say that you want to add before we move on in regards to Elephant Man?
No, I think it would, I would, you know, that would just take another 10 minutes.
So. Okay. Okay.
Watch the movie. Go see it. It is incredible.
It is.
Go see it in your living room.
Get it for your 12th birthday party for your kids.
Yes, exactly. It is a hit, a surefire hit.
Right then. This was a curveball for me, this next choice, not one I was familiar mm-hmm. with. So 1982's mm-hmm. The Atomic Cafe. Do you want to tell us what you're doing? I'm guessing renting this one.
Yeah, no, this was actually, so I was obsessed with Nuclear Armageddon as a child of the 80s, you know, that it was, you know, we just faced every day with this, you know, existential uncertainty.
Ten-year-old me asked my mother if we were going to have the bomb dropped on us, and she said, no, we're going to be all right.
Well, that's, you know, that conversation is essentially, you know, what's at the core of this movie. So, you know, so I, one of the other choices contenders for this that I was going to bring was the movie The Day After, which in America was this huge, the most watched event on television. My parents forbid me to watch it. And so I found in a dumpster, this black and white TV and like, secreted it up to my room to watch that. But so it was very difficult, you know, to watch that. But this movie, The Atomic Cafe, was sort of like on all the time. It was one of those movies that they showed on cable, just like, I don't know, the licensing was cheap for it or something. But
I guess, yeah, because I guess for the audience who doesn't know it, it's a series of 1940s and 50s United States government information about the impending apocalypse.
Yeah, exactly. So it's a documentary provisionally, and you're right, it uses like army training films, propaganda films, and then newsreel footage that documents the sort of advent of the atomic age. And you know, one of the things that I didn't realize as a kid, but you know, In terms of like my growing sort of like aesthetic sense, one of the things that this documentary is known for is that they did not have a narrator's voice in this whole movie. It is all composed exclusively of this archival footage. So you get this impression of this, like you watch this footage of this hydrogen bomb being detonated and this entire village being completely decimated, this sort of like model village. And then right after that, you see the like the duck and cover, you know, propaganda film, which a lot of people may be familiar with, but it was, you know, it shows these sort of like, you know, cheerful school children sitting in class. And then there's a white flash and then they all jump under their desks. And, you know, there's this reassuring narrator saying that like, all you have to do, you know, just duck and cover and you'll be safe from an atomic blast. And so, you know, the disparity, like the junction of those two pieces of media, this like, you know, archival footage of the actual effect of the blast. And then this like propaganda, you know, this sort of fanciful propaganda about that experience is a way to like enforce government control. Like it was the first, you know, it was like my first experience in like having insight into the fact that into, you know, like the systemic forces that, you know, that control our lives and that are working overtime to sort of like build this society that is all about destruction, you know, behind the scenes.
I was just thinking, Matt, as you're saying it, can you imagine getting the brief in the 40s and 50s where somebody says, hey, Matt, can you do us a bunch of propaganda right. videos that basically say the atomic bomb isn't a threat to your safety? That's what we need.
Right. Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. And I think a lot of Americans, you know, just bought into that and felt secure. And there's, you know, and so there's one moment in particular I wanted to try and get in before my 5 minutes are up, where another thing that I saw for the first time was there's this newsreel footage of Harry Truman right after they've dropped the bomb on Nagasaki. And what the documentary director did was to show you the footage before the newsreel started, where Harry Truman is like just talking shit with the film crew, and he's laughing, and then they're like, okay, start. And he immediately like his face falls, and he's like, we have just dropped a bomb and ended the war. And you know, that like this recognition that the people in power are just, you know, they are just fucking around. They're just people like us. It was sort of like sobering and terrifying and really eye-opening. So yeah, that's the
Atomic Cafe. No. And it's fascinating now, because you kept saying the phrase duck and cover, how that's now a clothing brand.
Right. Yes. Yeah.
Which is kind of mental when I think about it, if I think too hard about
totally.
It. That, you know, a phrase that would have horrified children growing up in and parents in the 40s, 50s is now yeah. just casual wear for men.
Yeah. A brand. Yeah.
Right. Your final choice of your three films that have impacted right. everything in adult life is something that for me speaks to like the core of the VHS boom in my mind. You know, this is VHS uh-huh. land, if ever it was. 1985's Enemy Mine. Do you want to talk us through what this is in terms of your film life?
Yeah. So, my brother and sisters were all like, we all grew up, we were weird kids. Like, we didn't like sports. We were all like, just had our, you know, heads in books all the time, and were drawing on the floor. And my dad he didn't really know what to do with us. Like, I think he secretly wanted us to all be into football, and so he was trying to connect with us. And the one point of connection was science fiction. He was a big sort of Star Trek fan, and so this was like the way he could connect with us. He didn't really do a lot otherwise, but. So when I was, you know, a kid, he saw this, you know, in the paper. He opens up the paper, there's this big ad for this movie Enemy Mine, which the poster for it has like Dennis Quaid facing off against this like fearsome looking reptilian played by Louis Gossett Jr. And, you know, you're like, oh, this is going to be an epic space battle. So we go to this movie and we're sitting in the theater, and, you know, it starts out that way. There's this sort of, you know, this detachment, the International Space Force detachment going to like battle these aliens. Dennis Quaid crashes. He, you know, comes into conflict with this alien that is, you know, an enemy of the human race. Then 20 minutes later, these two men are in this relationship, and you find out that this alien, the Louis Gossett Jr. character, like that race can reproduce without a mate. And so he becomes pregnant and gives birth to this baby. And, you know, Dennis Quaid is like the midwife for this birth. And so at the midpoint of this movie, you know, you're watching this very like tender, like non-traditional family that you know is created out of these two people who are forced into these circumstances beyond their control. And so I was completely blown away. Like, it was not at all the movie that I went in expecting, and it was sort of the first time I saw this model of shattering of this weird like masculine trope that you know I had become, you know, comfortable with in watching science fiction movies. It was you know, it was a very human story that was about this, you know, this family, and, you know, the Louis Gossett Jr. character dies, and then Dennis Quaid has to raise this kid on his own. And so, you know, you see him like trying to like become a father to this child on this weird alien world. And, you know, so watching it, rewatching it, I was like, okay, there, you know, some aspects of this movie have not aged particularly well, but I'm still kind of blown away by the way that it told this very human story, you know, using this, you know, like big space opera palette. And, you know, those are the kinds of, like, that's the kind of science fiction that I have always sort of like felt drawn to, like the sort of the silent running end of the spectrum you know, it's about like, how do we live in the future? And this, you know, and that was like, I hadn't really been exposed to anything like that before Enemy Mine. So it just, you know, it blew up the possibilities of like, A, like what, you know, like what a science fiction movie could be. And also like, you know, what a family could be and like what it means to be, you know, like a man. And like, it doesn't, you know, like, do I have to follow these, you know, stereotypes that I'm being bombarded with in the rest of my life? So, so yeah, it was just, it was hugely impactful, for those reasons, you know?
So that was kind of that was your sports game with your dad then, really. So that was
yeah, exactly. Yeah. And, you know, and so there's that angle too, where like I'm sitting in this theater with my dad who, you know, we didn't really have, he was a really quiet guy. Like we didn't really interact that much. I'm sure we did not said a word about the movie. Like we came out of the theater and got back into the family station wagon completely silent. Like we never talked about like what the movie meant, but it was, you know,
Our 5 minutes. It dawned on me actually, because I hadn't thought about it till you brought up on the list, is that, and I saw this film long after I'd seen Enemy Mine, is you ever see the 68 movie Hell in the Pacific? Where you've got a maroon Japanese soldier and a marooned American soldier. Uh-huh. And it's basically an anti-war film.
Uh-huh.
So you get that kind of two people who were basically want to fight each other at first, and then eventually, because they're marooned on an island, to survive, they have to.
Oh, that's, I have to check that out.
It's a glorious really film with Lee Marvin.
Oh, amazing.
And with Lee Marvin being a very much a man's man of acting, playing against the type of the kind of what.
Totally.
It starts off with the macho, but the pair of them end up having to not be because survival is not about who wins a fight.
Right. Exactly. It's about this kind of interdependence and you know, very much like which you know, yeah, it's very much about relenting power in, you know, to uplift community, really.
Indeed. Well, look, thank you very much for sharing your three films. Thank you for sharing a bit of the process that went into Gone in the Night. And it just gives me to say thank you very much for joining us on the Britflix podcast.
All right. Thank you, Stuart. This was awesome. Super fun.
Another season of The Palmetto Porch, an original podcast from Discover South Carolina. I'm Devin Whitmire. Join me as I get to the heart of what makes South Carolina such a great place to visit by speaking to the locals who make it so special. Premiering December 5th, find The Palmetto Porch wherever you get your podcasts. And for more information about our show, visit scpalmettoporch.com.
save big money at Menards. Let the fresh air in and keep the bugs out with replacement screen for your doors and windows from AdForce. It's easy to install, durable against the elements, and comes in a variety of types to suit your needs. Repair your screens today with a roll of replacement screen on sale through May 5th. And check out more great deals happening now in our weekly flyer on Menards.com. Save.